The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Novelist Camilla Shamsi calls our guest a writer of great humanity and intelligence who deeply understands how lives are shaped both by the grand sweep of history and the intimate encounters of human beings. Somali-British author Nadifa Muhammad is the writer of the acclaimed novels Black Mamba Boy and The Orchard of Lost Souls. A regular contributor to The Guardian and the BBC, she is a fellow Royal Society of Literature and is a lecturer in creative writing at Royal Holloway, University of London. Muhammad is the recipient of the Somerset Maugham Award and was named one of Granta's best young British novelists of 2013 and was part of the 2014 Africa 39 list of most promising writers under the age of 40 from sub-Saharan Africa. A finalist for the 2021 Booker Prize, her novel, The Fortune Men, reimagines the story of Mahmoud Matan, a young Somali sailor falsely accused of a violent crime in 1950s Cardiff, Wales. Writing for the Washington Post, Ron Charles praises equally informative and moving. The immediate allure of the novel is the vibrancy of Muhammad's prose, her ability to capture the complicated culture of Cardiff and the sound of tortured optimism. Tonight, Ms. Muhammad will be in conversation with Rabi Al-Medin, National Book Award nominated author of An Unnecessary Woman, The Angel of History, The Hakawati, and most recently, The Wrong End of the Telescope, which he discussed with us just a couple of weeks ago. It's a pleasure to have you both with us. The screen is yours.
Thank you so much, Andy. And thank you everybody for coming. The main event is one of my favorite people in the universe, Nadifa Muhammad, who, again, just one of my favorite people. And I don't say that lightly. I will tell some stories about her, but primarily it's been interesting to watch, for me, a young writer come to, I don't want to call it maturity because it sounds like a peak or something. It's just that the tremendous movement from the first two books to this one has been superb. And you saw, we saw it coming. She's, when she was, again, best promising writer for Granta and so on. And I don't think we should be using promising anymore. I was once introduced as an emerging writer and I wanted to tell people, no, I have emerged. I am no longer emerging. Again, this book is a masterwork. It's a work of an accomplished writer and it is truly magnificent. And that it so happens that one of my favorite people wrote one of my favorite books. It's just always a pleasure. So welcome, Nadifa. Welcome to Philadelphia. I know you're in London.
Yes, and you're in Virginia.
I am in Virginia, but we're supposed to be in Philadelphia.
We'll make believe.
We'll make believe. So Nadifa, let's start the conversation. And please, everybody listening, if you have any questions, just put them in the Q&A and we will try to go over them. But let's start with how you came to know about the book. What was the first sort of spark that led you to write it? And in some ways, how did you go about, and before you wrote it, how did you go about to think about it?
Mm-hmm. It was a long period of thinking. So I first found out about Mahmoud Matan and what had happened to him in 2004. Mm-hmm. A year or two after I'd finished university and with no creative ambition at all at the time. I just saw his face in the newspaper and it struck my mind as a strange case. But I worked for a film company after university, working on research and also screenwriting. And when that job came to an end, I wanted to write my own script and I thought this would make the perfect story for that script. And I began researching it. And the first person I went to in many ways, for most things, was my father. Mm-hmm. And it turned out, of course, that he had known Mahmoud because they were both Somali sailors who had arrived in Britain in 1947. And my father had very little to say about him. He just said that Mahmoud was an ordinary guy, nothing special about him, with no kind of sense of what would happen to him. You know, he wasn't someone that he thought would end up in mm-hmm. trouble at the time when they met. But then my father's story, which I found out more about while asking about Mahmoud, became so fascinating to me that I wrote a novel about him. And then I wrote another novel set in Somalia during the 1980s. And I was trying to work on something completely different as my third novel, something set in London and contemporary, when I lost my father in 2014. Mm-hmm. And the story that I was working on at the time, the novel, just wasn't working. It didn't satisfy anything. And there was this urge building in me to get back to that world of my father. And it was like it was a form of grief, but also a form of comforting to mm-hmm. enter that world of these old sailors who knew my father, knew Mahmoud, looked like them, sounded like them, had similar lives to them. So it was a very personal thing that got me back to thinking about Mahmoud's case. But once I started pursuing it, it took on a life of its own. And in the years between 2004 and 2014, the case file at the National Archives had been opened. Mm-hmm. So it's all, I kind of see it as fate, really, because if I'd started researching it in 2004, there would have been very little information publicly available. But in 2014, I was able to read the whole case file from his first arrest all the way through to the preparations for his execution. So it came quickly. The research was fantastic. It was enjoyable, even though it was such a grisly, horrible subject. And I also went to Cardiff and to London and to Somaliland to interview people who could tell me anything about this case and the people in it. In terms of the fiction, I knew that I wanted to stay close to the real incident and the real events. I didn't feel any need to amp up the drama or anything like that. The closer I got to Mahmoud, the real character, or what seemed to be the real character, the more fascinating he was. He was complicated and difficult and lovable, but also frustrating. And the way that the system sort of consumed him, destroyed him, was enough drama, I thought. It wasn't a case of making it into a murder mystery or a typical crime novel. And I wanted to focus in on the dialogue, the way that these people spoke, and how Mahmoud navigated all of these different lives that he had, all by the age of 25, 26. He'd been raised in a pretty comfortable family in Somaliland, and then decided to leave and crossed Africa, ended up in South Africa, joined the Merchant Navy, went everywhere around the world, and then settled in Cardiff because he fell in love. So it was the scope of the story. It was both the breadth of it and also the depth of it that I was trying to manage.
Okay, before we go on, let's give people a little bit of, a little taste of the novel. Could you read a short bit for us?
Yep.
Thank you.
I'll read from near the beginning, first chapter, when we're just getting to know Mahmoud and his life. The docks in Butte Town cover only a square mile, but for Mahmoud and his neighbours, it's a metropolis. Raised up from marshland the century before, a Scottish aristocrat built the docks and named the streets after his relatives. Mahmoud had heard a rumour that the world's first million-pound cheque was signed there at the coal exchange. Even now, in the morning, a different calibre of men come bowler-hatted to work at the Mercantile Marine Office or the Custom House. At both the Marine Office and Seamen's Union, you know which door to use if you don't want trouble, and this goes for the labouring white man as well as black. Beyond the financial district, the neighborhood is for everyone. All of them hemmed in and pushed close by the railway tracks and canals, cutting them off from the rest of Cardiff. A maze of short bridges, canal locks, and tram lines confuse the new visitor. just before his time, Somali sailors would wear the address of their lodging house on a board around their neck so that passers-by could help navigate them. The canals are a playground to young children. And once, when two went missing, Mahmoud had spent a blue, insomniac night searching the muddy water for any sight of them. They had been found in the morning, one white, one black, both drowned. But his boys are still too young to go wandering, alhamdulillah. One day, when they are older, he will show them around this port town with its Norwegian church and kosher abattoir, its cranes, booms, and smoking chimneys, its timber ponds, creosote works, and cattle yards, its three broad thoroughfares, Butte Street, James Street, Stewart Street, crisscrossed with ever-narrowing terraces, the flags and funnels of the world shipping fleets crowding the pierheads and sprawling across the dock basins. Mahmoud silently plans the future, but now, defeated by the icy chill sneaking itself through the gaps between his coat buttons, he decides against another night of poker and heads home to Adamsdown, where the real fire in his life burns.
That is wonderful.
Thank you.
So let's go back to Mahmoud, or Moody Mahmoud. I was fascinated, not unusual for you, but how fully fleshed out, felt so real the character is. And I'm fascinated by this because you just said that you didn't need to add any drama or any fictional aspects to it. And I was wondering, it's as if, you know, we take an ordinary life and how complex that ordinary life is one of my greatest fascination as a writer, that you could write about one single person and the entire universe is in it. So when did you realize when you were researching, before you wrote the book, that what you had was something special? Do you know what I mean? That you had a special guy. Because he is as ordinary as he is, he's also extraordinary. And that's the beauty of it. Go ahead.
It wasn't at the beginning, because when I was only able to access newspaper accounts of him and what had happened, they repeat the same facts again and again. And they also fictionalize him. They make him into a kind of simpleton, this naive foreign sailor who is killed because he's in love with a Welsh girl. And all of the fire in him is not there. And it was actually reading the case file and seeing how sharp he was and hostile and sarcastic towards the police that made me curious about him, because I knew that my father wouldn't have behaved like that in the 40s or 50s for his own self, you know, for keeping himself alive. He would know not to do that, but Mahmoud was doing that. And then his interviews with the prison doctor, they revealed a different side to him. So that's where I got some of the brief information about his childhood and family life in Somaliland. And that part is more fictionalized, partly because the information was scant. And then I also could, my father had traveled in a similar way in a different direction, but I knew those stories. Those were the stories that I grew up with. So I could now have fun by placing Mahmoud in places that I would want to go, like Zanzibar. I took him to Zanzibar. But Mahmoud came across as someone in the interviews I did as well, the people I met. There was a Nigerian man who had known Mahmoud and was one of the prosecution witnesses, and he was a watchmaker in Portobello Market, and I'd gone past his shop hundreds of times before I realized the connection. And he didn't like Mahmoud. They were not friends. They'd had a fight in the street with razor blades, but Mahmoud struck him as a wild man, he said. He was a wild man. He was crazy, but also stylish, good-looking. Someone who, Olabisi, the watchmaker, was also someone with a lot of fire in him. And even as a 90-year-old, he wanted to fight everyone. He had feuds with all of his neighbors. He was always saying, I hate her, I hate him. Have you seen that person? And I could see how they were similar. One of the reasons they clashed is because they were so similar. And I love cantankerous people like that. So Mahmoud was someone who, in real life, I think I would have a complicated relationship with. But as someone I was trying to commune with over time, over space like this, he was someone that I could very easily love.
And that's what I'm interested in, is the taking of sort of a two-dimensional person as presented by the newspapers and by various accounts. And then all of a sudden, he comes to life in your head and then comes to life on the page. And I find that process just stunning. Like, when does a character, in my work, I begin to see the character as if someone walking with me. You know,
me too.
And then putting it on the page. So there's the skill of imagining and then the skill of actually writing it. So did you have trouble with either?
Not this time round. My second novel was The Killer. That was the one that was horrible and felt like I was squeezing blood from a stone. This was the opposite. It was the quickest book I've ever written, the longest book I've ever written. It was 600 pages in its first draft. But it just flowed out. There was no pain. There was sorrow in it and anger, but no pain. And I felt as if I could live in that world for a really long time. I fell in love with Tiger Bay, with Mahmoud, with Berlin, with Diana. Mm-hmm. These were people I enjoyed, and I could see them and I could feel them, and I could, I didn't have to, it wasn't as if I was forcing them to do anything. Mm-hmm. I saw them very clearly in my mind. And Mahmoud's story is quite condensed in the novel. We meet him in March or late Feb. What is it? I can check. It's late Feb, and he's executed in September. Mm-hmm. So you have these few months of his life, which allows for that deep concentration. Most of the time in the novel, he's in jail. So there's an even closer connection to this still man and the world, that mobile world that he'd lived beforehand. And I went back and forth, and then also back and forth between him and Diana and Violet. So it didn't feel as if I was stuck at any point.
Mm-hmm.
It all felt very natural and eerie, as if, you know, the 17 years that it had taken me to, well, it's taken 17 years to get it published, but it took 11 years for me to get going on the writing process. And that pregnancy, that gestation was necessary. So when I sat down, it was completely smooth.
So that sounds wonderful. I'd love to get that.
I don't want to wait 11 years.
Yeah, exactly. My first couple of books, yes, they flowed easily, but then, you know, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah. I have a feeling that this will be the only book that it's like that.
Let's hope not. Again, sometimes it works, and it's. I always say it's like a marriage. You know, sometimes it's everything flows normally, and you don't have fights. And then sometimes you have fights, and
Yes.
And neither one is better than the other. It just, this is the way it progresses. Yeah. You're married to your books. Again, going back to, before we go to anything, because again, for me, the character is so astounding, you know, so from the way...
In what ways?
Well, from the way he dresses to his, I want to say he's so both present and slippery. You know, it's the combination of, I see him, but I can't get a hold of everything that he's supposed to be. And that's, for me, is a great character where I'm trying to figure it out. So when you're doing research like this, of course, you're restricted somewhat by the events that happened. Where do you take liberties? You started talking about it. And where do you have to stick to event? What do you think are the necessary sort of facts that have to remain there, and where do you take liberty in? Because this is in many ways a historical novel, but it is a novel. It's not, I mean that in the best sense of the word. It's like it's a great story, So how does one novelize history in some ways?
Well, my gut feeling is always to stay close to the facts. So Black Mamba Boy began as a biography of my father. That was the first intention. And then it drifted into becoming a novel because I couldn't access his inner world in the, through the interviews I was doing with my father. He was held back because of, you know, the traumas of his early life had to be contained. So he concentrated on the movement and the excitement and the constant change of his life. But I wanted to think about what he was thinking and feeling. And that was distant from my father's recollection. And in this case as well, so I don't think there's anything factually in the events that I've made up. Maybe tiny bits here and there, but the real liberty I took, the important liberty I took, was in allowing myself to think freely about what they would think and feel.
Yeah.
That was, and I think that's probably what gets writers into trouble. Because if you say, oh, they went there and they spoke to this person, no one really cares. But if you say they desired this person or they hated this person, that's where the challenge of dealing with real historical characters, I think, is really difficult. And I, the only way I could navigate that was by writing as if no one would ever read this. And Mahmoud was a young man who was quite uninhibited. You know, he was quite free of shame for a Somali man of that generation. He was ostracized. He stole money from the mosque. He didn't live with the Muslim community anymore, the Somalis or the other Muslims. So I got the feeling that he was someone, if I met him in person, who would just, who'd be happy with the blunt truth, just honesty, rather than hiding behind all of the culture and the stigma and shame that people have to deal with. So with him, I felt pretty free. And then with the other characters, such as Berlin, such as Diana, Violet, I did the same. I didn't inhibit what I allowed them as characters to think or feel or say. But in hindsight, when you remember that they are real people connected to real families, I think that the writer instinct kind of clams up a little bit. And the other side of you, you know, the person dealing with another person, is awakened, and that inhibition is really strong.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because I look at it as this struggle between making the novel great and, you know, being restricted by whether it is moral issues or factual issues.
Yeah.
But to make a novel great, you have to get into the character's head. And once you do that, you're making up all kinds of stuff. But that's what makes it good.
You are.
Yeah.
But then are you obliged to change their names or change...
This is what I was going to ask next. You know.
So I kept Mahmoud's name because it would be silly to pretend that this was anyone else's story apart from Mahmoud Matan. But I did change the murder victim's name and the name of her family, the people around her, because I was asked to by a family member, one of their family members. And that did allow me that a bit more distance as well. Mm-hmm. Because now I wasn't taking their real names in my mouth and putting words in their mouth. But yeah, it creates this dichotomy of Mahmoud being Mahmoud and everyone else around him being close to those real characters, but not quite. And I think one of the ways I remember actually now, all the way through, I would now and again get these attacks where I felt as if almost in a karmic way that I was meddling. Mm-hmm. I was meddling with this story, with this trauma that was much bigger than me, that was impacting his family over the generations, impacting the murder victim's family over generations. And I was intruding in that. And I kept sort of making these trades or bargains that I can do this if I do this, if I can write about him if I find out who the real killer was, or if it means that the case will be reopened, or, you know, whatever, all of these sorts of ethical bargains. And I still believe that. I do think that people talk now a lot about appropriation. But for me, I guess the word that I worry about is extraction. If you extract something without giving anything back. And especially when there's a power dynamic at play. Yeah. If I'm a writer who goes somewhere, takes a story, takes all of the benefits of that story and gives nothing in return, that to me feels kind of wrong.
I love discussing this because you're saying a lot of things that I want to say. But it's interesting to me, sort of the ethical dilemmas that come up when you're doing something like this, or in my case, when I was writing about refugees. And you know, what story is real, how much do you add, but it was constant. My way of dealing it was thinking that because I'm worried about it, that gives me an okay to do what I want.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I agree. I think if I didn't worry about it, I'd be a terrible person. But since I worry about it and I think about it, yeah, I'm a good person and I can do whatever I want. And I think I call that
you allow yourself to do.
Yeah, I call that the United States excuse. We're really good people, so we can bomb you over there.
We'll feel really bad about it afterwards.
Exactly. But as long as I get the book out, I'll you know, fine. And then I'll feel really bad about it and stuff. And that makes me, in many ways, excuses my behavior of stealing something. Yeah. If I feel bad about it, as if that's, I can actually, but that's how I deal with it.
But then do you also think, because in some ways, I do feel this story belongs to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a man that is a Somali man who was executed in this country that I live in, that it's a story that cannot belong too intimately with anyone. It has to be a public story.
Mm-hmm.
He's made legal history by being the first historical miscarriage of justice overturned in a British court. So there's that push and pull. You know, history is public, but the individuals within that history are still.
No, we could have this argument all day night that actually you have that story because you wrote it.
Question for me is mine.
Yes, it is yours. There's no two ways about it for me. The question begins, if you want to talk about appropriation, or is the whole idea of power, who has it, who gets to tell the story. But as long as you're thinking about it, for me, I know I was joking in the beginning, but that it's important to think about. But the story is yours. You're the one who's able to tell it. And you told it brilliantly. What you have to do is give it the respect that it deserves. And my God, you did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was done, you know, because Mahmoud is portrayed as being flawed, because he's human and real. If someone wrote about me, I'd be flawed. So I think because he's flawed, it can hide the fact that it's written with so much love and respect and grief for him in particular.
Because
I think we have got into this. Pardon?
It comes across clearly. Yes. No.
But maybe with this novel in particular, I've seen how people respond violently to things. So just today, a man was saying that the novel was well researched, but stereotypically racist about Caribbean or Jamaican men in particular. And I was trying to explain to him that I was keeping close to the real characters who were not likable men. One of them was a psychopath. So how do I make a psychopath likable? Am I obliged as a form of representation to make him likable? No, you can't. So there's always a feeling that people go to history to get something that makes them feel good. And history is not for that. Politics is not for that. We're not there. It's not there to make us feel good. It's meant there to be the as close to veracity as possible.
Mm-hmm. And people go to novels to make them feel good. And novels never
make
them feel good. No, I mean, the whole idea for me of safe novels is a joke. It's like, you know, I don't want to feel safe when I'm reading a novel. I want to be pushed and shoved and threatened. And great art is never safe.
No.
Yes, Yes, it's like, yes, of course, you could portray this differently or you could do this differently, but it is not your job. Your job, your fabulous job is to write this great novel.
So how do you, if I'm now tempted to not write about real people again. I think I've had my fill of it.
I avoid, what about you? I mean, unless I'm writing an essay and usually it's about me and even that I lie. I know I'm a liar. I mean, it's, I was born that way. I'm a Lebanese, you know, we lie the minute we open our mouth, but we only lie to tell a better story, you know, to tell.
It's important. It's yes, important.
Yes, it's important. Again, we, the people and our opinion will die. Hopefully the novel, you know, goes on. So we don't matter as much as the book itself. Now you do your best. And again, it comes across in this book, believe me, that pay the story the utmost respect. And you would do, I would do that whether the story is real or not real. You pay it the respect that it deserves. And any writer who does not do that is a bad writer. So yes, you might hurt someone over here. You might, this one person might be upset over there. But historical novels would be, for me, would be difficult, you know, to write about a certain person. Sorry, this is my thing because I lie. I started writing about my father, and within the first two pages, I was talking about his conception on a boat, and I'm thinking like, how would I know this? I make things up. It's my thing. So for me, I avoid reality. But
yeah.
So,
well, I've grown up around men who are self mythology. You know, my dad believed in his own self mythology, and Dady, my close friend, believed in it. And why not? You know, that makes their lives. I think it helps you survive, firstly, and then it centers you, and it centers you within your family. It centers you within your society. Who wants to be just a bland person?
And if
we all wrote in a very circumscribed way, we'd end up with very bland characters.
Which is most of modern contemporary literature. but it's not that. For me, like I keep saying, it is the importance of storytelling in our lives, whether it's the, you know, Somalis that I've met, or the Lebanese, or the Syrians, or the Turks. Storytelling is extremely important, and oral storytelling is, so that we tell stories, and you can never tell a story without exaggerating. It's just impossible, you know.
Or hiding,
exactly. So the whole idea of storytelling, so it becomes less about the person for me as respecting the story itself, respecting the storytelling aspect of it. So I don't care whether my father did this or not. I care whether the story that he told was good enough or not. That's how we measure people as a writer, I love this. So let's talk before we go to questions, just sort of the last question. London, what was the most surprising thing about your research? What was the one thing that go, oh my God?
The end, how his life ended. That was brutal to read about because I didn't, I looked for some documentation and there was nothing official. But then I found out about a book written in Welsh by a policeman who said that his uncle, I think it was, had been one of the warders with Mahmoud in his last moments in jail. Mm-hmm. And so I got a translated English copy of that book, and it was harrowing, so harrowing. And they described how Mahmoud had refused to get out of the prison issue pajamas and wear a suit that they'd found for him to wear for his death, and that he'd struggled, and that he'd held out his hand to the executioner, thinking it was a man who was coming to say everything was fine and he could go. That was shocking to me, really shocking. And having traveled with Mahmoud psychologically for so long and seen him, you know, seen his hope and his belief that things would be all right, and to know that he was alone. And actually, I forgot the last, the worst detail was the kind of gobbledygook that they put as Mahmoud's last words. And it was a very bastardized version of Bismillahi Rahmani Rahim. Those were his last words. And because they didn't know anything about Islam, they didn't know that he was, you know, trying to pray as he was hanged. And that hurt. That hurt.
It kills, yeah. So we have some Q&A. Would you like to do the Q&A or would you like to read another piece for us? It's up to you.
Let's go to questions and I'll end with the reading.
Okay. So let's go to questions. The first question is from Judith Price. What is the meaning of the title?
Thank you, Judith. So the Fortune Men comes, it's a phrase. It's a phrase that my father told me a long time ago, which was used when he was young for men like him who went to join the Merchant Navy, who went to sea. So they were called the Fortune Men, partly because they were expected to make a fortune at sea. It was a very well-paid job for them. But also the other element of it was that you were putting your life in the hands of fortune. Many people didn't return. They died at sea or moved to places where they never came back from. So it was the word, the name of a generation of men, including Mahmoud, including my father. And and Mahmoud in particular, as a gambler, as someone who constantly risked everything, I thought that was really interesting.
Okay, next question is from William Barner. Would you talk about the use of the Arabic numbering of the chapters? Was it to reframe his story more authentically as his own? Thank you. It is a moving, remarkable, and entertaining read.
Thank you. It's not Arabic, as Rabbi could tell you. It's Somali, which is a different language group altogether. So it's the numbers Ko, Laba, Sadeh, Afar, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to Khalas, which is an Arabic word, which means enough, the end, finished. The numbers go up to, they count down. I think in that same book I was telling you about, the Welsh language book, they said that it took about 17 seconds for Mahmoud to be executed. So I count down in Somali, down to 16 until the last moment, as a way of, it's like a beat. I imagined it as a drum beat of his life ticking. But also in Somali, when you start a story, you often go, Ko, one, let's begin there. And then you start telling the story. So that felt very natural. Yeah, I don't think I've seen a Somali, a book with Somali chapter heading. So I thought, why not?
Why not indeed? This question is from Terry Smith. It says, I was fascinated by Mahmoud's critique of British law and injustice from the Somali perspective. Such different ways of being and perceiving the world. Would you talk a bit about this?
Sure. So that was actually, that was also enlightening for me. That's something that came out of the research when I was researching the British empire, particularly in Somaliland and East Africa, and how they tried to impose themselves. So Somaliland was a small, poor part of the British Empire. They were not interested in the same way that they were interested in India or Kenya or all these other places. There was little money to be made there. But of course, they still needed it, because if they didn't take it, the French would take it or someone else would take it. So the British had their way. They would tax. They would try and open schools against local opposition. And they were very insistent that their British justice system would be imposed in Somalia, including the death penalty, which didn't exist in the same way in Somalia. What you would have is feuds, and this is quite common in many societies, where if someone is killed, the families of both parties, the perpetrator and the victim, will have to come to some sort of agreement for compensation and then forgiveness, and that can hold, there can be that kind of justice, reparative justice. But if that doesn't work, both groups will be feuding sometimes for decades. And it's a way of, there's something about that British, or not just British, but Western, do I want to say Western, idea of it being very bureaucratic, cold-blooded, scientific, rational, which is it clearly isn't, and taking this person and saying, which there could be a way of repairing this situation, but we don't want to. We want to take your life. And they did that in Somaliland, and there was lots of back and forth conflict about this. You had the Somali legal code, then you had Sharia, the Islamic legal code, and then you had the British on top of that. So you have these three different ways of looking at things, which probably have passed down to me in some way. And I, because I've grown up in Britain, the British one is the one at the forefront of my mind, but it's incredibly flawed. And it's quite interesting to step out of what you think of as being right, and wondering how else it could be. And Mahmoud comes to the conclusion that the Somali system is actually superior because it deals with people as individuals, but also as part of a collective. And the idea is if you do harm, you have to correct that harm. And in this case, the British system did two harms. They did not find Lily Volpert's killer, and then they killed an innocent man on top of that. So nothing good came out of their system in his case. But there's also like maybe Rabbi can also talk on this, on the kind of hostility to cultural relativism. Often when you say people do this differently somewhere else, and that's perfectly acceptable for them, I feel like there's often a lot of hostility because people are very set in their idea of human rights means this, justice means this.
And also, I mean, it is important for what colonialism mean and why it lasted so long. A lot of it had to do with the legal system, that the feeling that the Western legal system is the right one. It's still very prevalent right now. So that they came and conquered and were in Somaliland basically to save Somalis from themselves and from the legal system. It is a big deal to, I mean, in India, for example, the whole British fiction, basically, that they were saving women from all kinds of problems was fascinating. You know, it still goes on. It's like they're saving, you know, homosexuals in Afghanistan. They are saving and again, for those of us who grew up in the West, of course, we think that the Western legal system is, for norms. Me, is the norm, and it's the best, in my opinion. However, it has been used as a way to perpetuate dominance for a long, long time, and it's not easy for Westerners to possibly entertain the idea that, you know, there could have been a world without the Western legal system.
And the hypocrisy of that, because when British people killed Somalis, they were not hanged, and they were not hanged in India or South Africa or any of these places. They would offer compensation. And that's what they still do. You know, if there's a drone strike and five children are killed, oh, here's some money, here's a few dollars, and keep going, you know, move on with your life. So it's so strange that the laws that they say that they are using to civilize people are not there to be. Once it comes to their own concerns, they follow a different system altogether.
Yeah, and again, it's just for me, it's the whole idea of how Westerners. I mean, this is sort of one of the last pillars that, you know, our legal system. We made the world civilized. You know, if it weren't for us.
Yeah, and we can hold other people to account. When people commit genocides, we hold them to account.
Yes, and you know, it's a fascinating thing. Anyway, next question is from Whitney McKay. I loved how he looked at his life as a Western movie and a Technicolor spectacle that at one point fades to black and white. Was this your invention? It certainly fits his bold character.
The latter one is. But when he compares, so when he talks about his life being this wild, there's two elements to that. The Western bit is something that I got from his interviews with a prison doctor. where he's chatting to the prison doctor, and he says, Mahmoud, the real Mahmoud, says, I saw this film once and it was a Western, and this man came to a new town and everyone accused him of a murder he didn't commit. And then one by one, these false witnesses were held to account and he was set free. And the prison doctor was the one who described it as a wild and woolly tale. And it ended up in the archive. And Mahmoud was obsessed with films, and you know, people would go to the cinema every night. It was cheap, it would keep you warm. It was a way of meeting people, socializing when you lived in these tiny boarding houses. So I think that was a big point of reference, and for me as well. So when the expectation in something like this is that ticking clock and that fight for justice, that's what Hollywood has taught us, that, you know, someone will find the clue that will absolve him of any suspicion. And that never happened. Of course it didn't happen. So Mahmoud is torn between these filmic tropes that he knows and can take comfort from, and then the bleak reality of his life in this prison cell for 6 months, where there is no hero. He's not a cowboy. He's not all of these things that he's fantasized. He's a young black man in a hostile British state prison.
Okay, one more from Roger Dirtman. I feel like this novel shares something of the literary tradition of The Stranger. If so, could you discuss it a bit? And does it also share something in American literary tradition, especially given our current struggles with racial justice, immigration, etc.?
It's really, quite a few people have said about resonances with The Stranger, and I haven't read it, or I read it so long ago, I can't remember. But I read Kamal Daoud's book, The Meursault Investigation, which is, it takes on the story of the Arab man who's killed and his family. And that I found really powerful. I love that novel. The other American, the American novel that I didn't read it until the end because I didn't want it to influence me, was In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. And the funny thing was, that I read it towards the end of the novel, or even after I'd finished the first draft, and he'd made similar choices. I read about the real case and compared how he had written it in Cold Blood, and we did similar things without me intending that. So I guess Truman Capote was insistent that it was all truth, that it wasn't a novel, that it was all truth. And I don't know why he stuck to that, because he did fabricate parts of it, while I've been open about the fact that it's a novel and it's not meant to be taken as truth. And this relationship to trust, I guess, the trust that the reader's meant to have in what you're telling them. So a reader could go away from reading my novel with the facts of the case and a very deep combination of facts from different places, different sources, but it will still be read as a novel. So for me, I found that comforting. I didn't want to be pretending to be the last word on this. And I think that's what Truman Capote was doing. So that is one main difference. But I think he started this relationship between fiction and nonfiction that's still very strong now. In terms of books in the US that discuss race, I think, you know, the obvious ones such as To Kill a Mockingbird, I find them quite alienating in the way that they treat the black figures. You know, they're either too angelic or victimized, or sometimes, you know, even having, you know, that trope of the magical black man who's there to fix the white people, even though he has to sacrifice his own life, this kind of Christ-like figure. I didn't want any of that. I wanted him to be someone who stuck his hands up at British society, who didn't give a damn, didn't care about their souls. He cared about his own.
Okay, and this is a good question to end with. Do you feel like you are done with the story, or do you have more to tell?
No, never. I'll never be done. And I did an event in Cardiff in late October, and someone handed me a letter from a 90-something-year-old man who said that he'd been in jail with Mahmoud in 1952, And he told me some really shocking details. He said that Mahmoud's grave had been dug by three teenage Somali inmates of the prison, and it was in a spot where Mahmoud could watch it being dug. So he was in this big window in the execution suite looking down at the grave. And I found that really traumatizing and upsetting. I just thought that there were things I protected myself from. There was no archival record of any violence beyond him being put in a straitjacket to Mahmoud in jail or in the police station. But I know deep down that they would have been violent towards him. And I've protected myself from thinking about it too much. And this kind of broke that defense. So he sent me his number. I've got his number, and I want to talk to him about what else he remembers. And I still haven't given up the idea that I will find the real killer. I think I know who the real killer is. And just with a bit more time, I can get more evidence and give it to Cardiff Police.
Nadifa, the true detective.
Yeah, Mrs. Marple.
Mrs. Marple. I actually see you more as a Hercule Poirot.
Okay, I'll take that. I'll get a moustache.
Okay, so we could read the last bit if you want, if it's not too long.
Which last bit?
You said you had another piece to read, or like I said, we could end it here. I have no problem.
No, I'll read. I've got my reading. So this is a turning point in Mahmoud's early life. He's probably 14 here, and he's run away from home all the way to Tanzania. And he's been found by Somalis and reported to his mom, and he's been told to go back and come home and stop being so ridiculous. So he's been given a bit of money to return back to Somaliland by the woman he was working for. Sitting on a wooden bench on platform one of the central station at Dar es Salaam, waiting for a train he didn't want to ride, Mahmoud picked listlessly at a packet of chaat that he had just bought from an Indian hawker, the red flash of his cart squeaking up and down the platforms, having kept Mahmoud company over the past hour, now stilled. The trader stopped and stretched his back, complaining in Hindi as he pressed his thumbs into his spine. "Poor men get no rest till they die, na," he said to Mahmoud in Swahili, shaking his head ruefully. Mahmoud shrugged his shoulders. He'd had his fill of rest. "The Arusha train late," the Indian continued, eager to give his tongue some respite from the mantra of one bag, three bags chat, 10 cents. "I don't know, must be. It was due half an hour ago." Mahmoud spread his hands apart and leant back, a picture of lassitude. "Where are you going?" "Hargeisa." The hawker lifted his eyebrows. "British Somaliland, long way." He sprinkled chat from his small shovel into his palm and then threw the mix of spiced rice, nuts and lentils into his mouth. "You should have taken a dhow." "I will, from Mombasa." "You have money to burn?" "I don't, but the woman who bought me the ticket does." "A real tajira?" "Rich dead husbands." "Lucky woman." "Where do the other trains go?" "Mwanza, Tabora, Kigoma, Kitadu, Tanga, Dodoma, Mpanda." "I was one of the men who extended the tracks from Tabora to Mwanza a long, long time ago. There's not much I don't know about this railway. You could go to Tanga, get a dhow from there. The ticket worked for all of them? Let me see." Mahmoud pulled out the flimsy yellow rectangle from his shirt pocket and unfolded it. Holding the paper close to his eyes, the hawker checked all the details. "Second class, yes. It will take you anywhere in Tanganyika." Mahmoud refolded the ticket and placed it back in his pocket, beside the 10 shillings Bibi Sahra had given him for the journey. "Maybe I'll go to Tanga then." "Safar salama, either way. Asante." Creaking away with his cart, the Indian had planted a seed in Mahmoud's mind. There was no compulsion to do what he had been told. He did not need to go home, or even north. What was ahead of him in Hargeisa? A tearful reunion with his mother, followed quickly by punishment, the mundane routines of the family shop, the long wait for his brothers to marry, one by one, before it was his turn. He wanted to see more beauty, more of the world's strange places, animals and women. He wanted to see palaces, great ships, mountains, fire worshippers, and fire-headed girls. When it was the sand came to mind, scratching at his eyes and whipping at his clothes, the tusbah clacking elders calling everything new the work of Shaitan. The interminable negotiations between clans over land, women and wells. It was a place for the old, not those just starting out in life. Hearing the hollow whistle of a train about to depart from another platform, Mahmoud grabbed his small cotton bundle of clothes and ran over the bridge towards the shining black train. "Where you decide, boy," the hawker exclaimed in delight. Thick plumes of steam from the squat funnel shrouded any sign of where the locomotive might be going. Mahmoud turned back and threw his hands in the air before clambering up the steep wooden steps into a carriage. "Only Allah knows." The angry bull exhalations of the engine, and then the zug, zug, zug of the turning wheels as the locomotive jolted the carriages away from Dar es Salaam gave Mahmoud the feeling that he was heading off to war.
That is absolutely lovely. So
thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. If you go to the chat, you could buy the book, which you should, because this is really what it's all about. Again, thank you all for attending, Nadifa. It is my great, great, great pleasure to interview you. Good night, everybody.
And my pleasure to be interviewed by you.
Thank you so much, sweetie.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.